Ooh, I have to tell you this true fact about wolf spiders. And
okay.
You're gonna have your mind blown.
I'm excited about it.
So wolf spiders are nocturnal and they're active hunters. And they typically form a burrow. So at nighttime, they leave their burrow and they go hunting and then they have to find their way back by daytime.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have 8 eyes, right? Those 2 big ones in the front are how they see prey. They have 2 that are kind of like slightly above and back that are just light dark. So it's just like for extra like sensories of like where their surroundings are when they're hunting. And then the 4 that are underneath those 2 big ones are their odometer.
Ooh.
And their compass.
Ooh.
So when they leave their burrow, they remember, okay, I went this direction this many steps. And then I went that direction in that many steps. So in order to get back to my burrow, instead of going back that many steps and then back that many steps, I'm just going to take the hypotenuse of that triangle.
That's fucking sick. Fucking eat your shit, Pythagoras. Like,
wolf spiders.
Yeah. Damn, that's cool as fuck.
Yeah. I just went down a rabbit hole with spiders one day and I just learned a bunch of true facts. And when I learned that about wolf spiders, I read like a whole article about it. If I find it, I'll send it to you so you can link
Please
it.
Please do.
It's like a whole study where they had a bunch of female wolf spiders that they made little blinders for so they could cover different eyes and make them go through this maze.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. I could use something to pull me out of marmot territory for a little bit, learn about something else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just kind of slowly learning that if I were to go in for my master's, I'd probably study spiders. I think spiders are so fucking cool.
Hell yeah.
But yeah. Anyways, hi. How's it going?
What's up, dude?
What's up, dude? What's
it's, up?
It's Karina.
And Clark.
And welcome to It's Always Spooky.
It's always spooky.
It works so well because I literally just sent you that beatboxing song, Dopamine.
Oh, perfect.
So you can listen to it later.
Yeah, and then I can be in the car and be like... practicing my beatboxing skills.
Beatboxing. Today, I'm actually pretty excited for today's material. Because it hasn't been like one of my favorite horror movies. When you suggested it, it wasn't that I wasn't excited to watch it. I was excited because I don't watch it that often.
Yeah.
So we're doing 2018's Hereditary.
Yeah.
It's written and directed by Ari Aster.
And
it was his debut film.
And he did a fucking damn good job.
Phenomenal job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there's, I will link, or actually, let me pull it up really quick just so that I have the name of the video and the name of the creator handy.
Yes.
But a lot of the kind of special things that I learned about this show or about this movie was because of a video titled Hereditary, The Complete Guide, Everything Explained by Novum.
Mm-hmm.
If you are somebody who is as obsessed with Hereditary as I have been, this video is 4 hours and 37 minutes worth of content. Mm-hmm. And it breaks down literally every piece of symbolism, all of the lore behind the big bad in the movie. And it is comprehensive, to say the least.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I think I didn't even get halfway through it. And I learned way more about that movie than I thought it was going to.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those things where it's like, why would I do the research when he already did?
No shit. Well, and I didn't even cover it all, so.
No, no.
But anyways, to get through the rest of the metadata, I do have the tagline. There's 2 of them. Every family tree hides a secret, and evil runs in the family.
Love both of them.
The title card for this movie, there isn't one. They don't actually don't have a title card until the end credits.
Mm-hmm.
So I just actually had just the treehouse with the, I think it's Elwes symbol on the front of it, which stands for like shielding or protection.
Mm-hmm.
And I will bring it up because typically we do bring up our title card at the very end of the movie before we get into spoiler territory. It brings up just the title, Hereditary. And the T turns red and it drops down into Ari Aster's name. And then a different letter, A or whatever, turns red and drops down into the next name. And so it's showing like generations, like as it's moving down the credits list.
I love it.
I thought it was really clever.
And for this being a debut, that's fucking nuts, because as Novum says in that video, this is like formulaically a perfect horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into ratings and stuff later and like whether or not we agree with that. But for this to be a debut movie, and I'm excited to learn what it made and everything.
Oh, yeah.
But it, for people who don't even watch horror, they know about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those ones that has like spanned genres, spanned interests, where people are just like, yeah, no, that movie fucks.
Oh yeah. Or yeah. I feel like it could even have that staying potential of like Halloween, for instance, where people who haven't seen the movie know that clucking sound.
Or they know that I am your mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. They can like conjure those scenes, right? Even though they haven't actually seen the movie. This movie stars Toni Collette, who plays Annie.
Mother.
Millie Shapiro, who plays Charlie. Gabriel Byrne, who plays Steve. And then Alex Wolff, who plays Peter.
Peter?
There's a couple of other actors in here. I typically just do like the top build cast, but you do also have like
Joan.
Yeah,
and I don't know Joni. Who plays Joan.
Holy shit, Joni's really far down there. Ann Dowd plays Joni.
I was gonna say I knew her from Handmaid's Tale.
Right. Budget for this movie was $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
The opening weekend was June 10th of 2018. It made $13.5 million.
Okay.
It grossed worldwide $87.7 million.
Damn. They did it.
On a fucking $10 million budget. In 2018.
They did it. Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fucking impressive as shit.
And then I believe it was not that long after this one, Midsommar, came out, right?
Not very long.
Yeah.
If this came out in 2018, Midsommar was the next year, in 2019.
He's making money.
Yeah, no shit.
Making some damn money.
Yeah. Yeah, crazy. Like, I wonder if he did film them almost back to back.
Yeah.
We should do our spoiler-free recap. That is a very long plot summary. Holy shit, bro. Okay, one is a single sentence, and the other one is like a fucking paragraph. So the single sentence one is, a grieving family is haunted by tragic and disturbing occurrences.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I think is pretty accurate. It's about a family who recently experiences the death of their matriarch, who mm-hmm. passed away in their home. So like they were caretaking for her. And it has like a bunch of strange occurrences happen in the wake of her death that are very specifically targeting the family and like not only their sanity, but also like their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Themes.
I only wrote down a couple for this one.
Uh-huh.
There are definitely a lot more that you could kind of like get in the weeds with, but I wrote down three: family trauma, grief, and mental illness.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are definitely the big three. I would even, just because we've already done our spoiler free recap, so after this point we're into spoilers. Yeah. I would even also call it like a folk horror or like a cult horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Ari Aster who said that Hereditary was, what did he call it? He said it was like a long traditional, like occult story, but it's told from the point of view of the sacrificial lamb.
Oh, okay.
Right. So it's like this longstanding journey of like trying to get this ritual completed, almost like Paranormal Activity almost too. Right.
Yeah.
And then like, but instead of it, being told from that perspective, it's like it's told specifically and showing you the demise and the downfall of the sacrificial lamb of the ritual that's coming up.
I like that. I think in Novum's video, he said something to the effect of it's a supernatural metaphor for mental illness, which is a metaphor for a supernatural issue. And so it's just like a metaphor sandwich.
Interesting. Yeah. I kind of like that too. I really do like that. Yeah. Cause there's some, interesting dialogue that's in this movie later on. I'm gonna bring it up about like a theory that Annie starts to have, like as the occurrences happen and like her take on the events versus like what's actually happening.
Yeah. I do have some lore that I wrote down.
That's what I was curious about. I was like, is there some lore we could get into?
There is definitely some lore. One of the things that I really appreciate about this movie is that the big bad Paimon isn't exclusive to the Hereditary universe.
No.
Paimon is something that has been in literature, in the real world, over and over and over again.
Very well-known demon.
Very well-known demon. And I wanted to give the option of, I can either do kind of my summary of the lore, or I also wrote down the entire passage from the Lesser Key of Solomon that talks about him, and it's fairly short, but me being me, I had a copy of the Lesser Key of Solomon in my house, so I was like, I can just note this down.
That's fucking awesome.
But I wanted to give the option either way, because he is referenced primarily in the Lesser Key of Solomon, but he spans a lot of different grimoires.
Yeah.
He's right. Mentioned in several things.
I mean, I'm down to hear the whole passage.
Let's do it.
I'm okay. Fucking down.
All right. Let me grab my other notebook.
My other notebook.
So the Lesser Key of Solomon states, okay, so he is the ninth demon the ninth spirit that is listed in the Ars Goetia in the Lesser Key of Solomon. And it says 9, Paimon. The ninth spirit in this order is Paimon, a great king, and very obedient unto Lucifer. He appeareth in the form of a man sitting upon a dromedary with a crown most glorious upon his head. There goeth before him also a host of spirits, like men with trumpets and well-sounding cymbals, and all other sorts of musical instruments. He hath a great voice and roareth at his first coming, and his speech is such that the magician cannot well understand unless he can compel him. This spirit can teach all arts and sciences and other secret things. He can discover unto thee what the earth is and what holdeth it in the waters, and what mind is and where it is, or any other thing thou mayest desire to know. He giveth dignity and confirmeth the same. He bindeth or mayeth any man subject unto the magician if he so deserve it. He giveth good familiars and such as can teach all arts. He is to be observed towards the west. He is of the order of dominations. He hath under him 200 legions of spirits, and part of them are of the order of angels, and the other part of the potentates. Now, if thou callest this spirit Paimon alone, thou must take him some offering, and there will attend him two kings called Labal and Abelin, and also other spirits who be of the order of potentates in his host in 25 legions. And those spirits which be subject unto them are not always with them, unless the magician do compel them. His character is this, which must be worn as a layman before thee, etc. And then it shows the symbol that is shown in Hereditary.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so kind of expanding on that a little bit, he's referenced in different grimoires as Paimon, Paimonia, Paimonia spelled a different way, Baymond, and Baymon. Yeah. For the most part, that has most of my notes included in that. One of the things that I thought was really cool to bring up was that if he is summoned, he has a really hoarse voice, and he'll shout first, but then you have to command him to speak. And once you command him to speak, he will speak in his native tongue. And then you have to tell him to speak in your tongue. So he's trying not to be understood over and over again.
That's
until you're like, no, you have to speak to me the way that I can understand. And I think that is reflected in certain parts of the movie where there are things happening that are tied to Paimon in a way of like a spirit trying to communicate, but nobody can really understand him.
Right.
Or nobody recognizes the signs. So I think that was like their cinematic representation of being like, oh, he's speaking his language.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and I think in that Nova video also, from what I remember, there was some interesting dialogue that Charlie had. Like whenever, like especially in the beginning when they're supposed to go to the funeral and Charlie was sleeping in the treehouse and Dad comes up and is like, oh, for God's sake, Charlie, it was freezing out here last night. That's how you catch pneumonia. And Charlie's just like, that's okay.
Yeah.
And it was just a very nonchalant, like, you know, that's okay. I could freeze to death, whatever. And Novum was saying that that could be, there could be pretext there, or like this subtext there that Paimon wants to die because he wants a male host. He doesn't want a female one. So he's like, fuck it. I don't care if I die of pneumonia. Who gives a shit?
It's also one of those things where part of Charlie's communication is the tongue clucking that she does. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of representations, Paimon, even though he is a man on a camel, he looks very bird-like.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, oh, well, this is a bird communication that's coming through. And a lot of people kind of took that as like tongue popping sort of situation, but it's supposed to be a cluck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They probably associated it with some sort of tick because, right, like they picked Millie Shapiro, who has, I think she has clitocranial dysplasia, which is like a disorder. It's not, it's like a genetic mutation where your facial structure and your collarbones, it like don't form properly. And it takes a little bit longer, even like surgery, to correct. And so she looks kind of off. And they even have her being portrayed as in like special needs, like special education classes. And so I'm wondering if lots of people associated that clucking with like a tic that she has.
Yeah.
When really like it is, it's Paimon just like communicating.
It was one of those layers of like, oh, this is a lot of people would associate, which is incorrect, but a lot of people would associate being in special needs classes with some sort of mental health issue.
Right.
And so that's one of those layers, like Novum stated, of like, oh, mental health issue that is a metaphor for actually something spiritual that's happening or something supernatural that's happening.
Right.
And
that's also being portrayed as a mental illness. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So fun. So many layers to this movie. That's all that I had for lore.
For lore.
Just because I feel like you can really go into like cult behavior and all that kind of stuff. But I think especially knowing that we're going to eventually be covering Midsommar, like we'll get into cult shit then.
True. That's, yeah. Even though this is about a cult, we don't get to learn too much about their cult.
No.
Right. Other than like what they were doing to summon Paimon. We don't really know too much else beyond like what Annie's entire upbringing probably was, if like her mom was secretly like, well, I shouldn't say secret in quotation marks, because that's what she says at her funeral. She's very secretive. She's a very ritualistic woman. And so I'm kind of wondering like what her upbringing was like.
Yeah.
What that looked like.
Yeah.
What lessons were drilled into Annie from birth.
Yeah.
Because they were drilled into her brother at birth, which is why he committed suicide, right? Like, interesting. Are you ready to get into our favorites?
Yeah.
Or we could even do quotes if you want to do quotes.
We can do quotes. I have two. One of them is very long.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. I feel like I have two also, but... I think I know which one you have.
Yeah.
Oh.
It is from literally one of my favorite scenes in cinema.
In all of cinema history.
And it is also the, like, this is the pinnacle for an argument that awards neglect horror, because there is no fucking way that Toni Collette should not have won an award for this movie.
I know.
No fucking way.
The awards don't matter.
The awards don't matter.
Who gives a shit about some dumbass fucking award that somebody else created, some like academy or whatever?
And
who
plus,
gives a shit?
Half of them don't even watch the fucking movies.
Exactly.
So,
who honestly gives a shit?
Yeah. We actually have better credentials to give a fucking award than most of them do.
Yeah.
So,
do your quote.
All right. Don't you swear at me, you little shit. Don't you ever raise your voice at me. I am your mother, you understand? All I do is worry and slave and defend you, and all I get back is that fucking face on your face, so full of disdain and resentment and always so annoyed. Well, now your sister is dead, and I know you miss her, and I know it was an accident, and I know you're in pain, and I wish I could take that away for you. I wish I could shield you from the knowledge that you did what you did, but your sister is dead. She's gone forever. And what a waste. If it could have maybe brought us together or something, or if you could have just said I'm sorry or faced up to what happened, maybe then we could do something with this. But you can't take responsibility for anything. So now I can't accept and I can't forgive because nobody admits anything they've done.
Pop off. That was one of my quotes, was that fucking face on your face.
Yeah.
That fucking face on your face.
It's so iconic. And I wish even after watching this movie as many times as I have, I wish that I could hear that in Toni Collette's voice, but I only hear it as Trisha Paytas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. My second quote is from earlier in the movie, from Ellen's funeral. Mm-hmm. And it's when Annie gets up to the podium and says, "It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched and probably a little suspicious."
Yeah. I love that one. Honestly, mine is also by Annie, which is just really fucking funny because you already said that fucking face on your face. My other one is when they come home from Ellen's funeral and Annie looks at her husband, Steve, and goes, "Should I be sadder?"
We all have those people where it's like, when they go, we're going to be like, "Should I be sadder?
Should I be sadder?" Dude, right?
So good.
Let me see here. Oh, a deleted scene quote. That's fucked. That's a cool ass quote. Rude. It's a deleted scene from Steve. "You know, Annie, you can always build a shrine to all the terrible things in the world, but it doesn't mean that you have to destroy anything that is good."
Ooh. Ooh. Steve spitting truths.
Right? Yeah, I like this one. Steve climbs up into Charlie's treehouse to discover that she spent the night sleeping there. "Oh, Charlie, for God's sake, come on." Charlie wakes up, stands in the corner. "It was freezing last night. That's how you get pneumonia." "Charlie, that's okay."
"That's okay."
Well, all right then. Let's get into our fucking favorites.
You want to go first?
I have so many. honestly. Because I have the dinner confrontation as one of my honorable mentions for favorite.
Same.
Because if we're being honest, like, that is one of those scenes that, like, I was kind of gritting my teeth at. Mm-hmm. And it was from Annie's perspective because, like, yes, Peter accidentally killed his sister, right?
Yeah.
But, and I remember we said this several times when we were watching this movie, but Steve and Annie are not good fucking parents.
No.
And especially Annie. Like, I can tell Steve is fucking trying. And he's pulling a lot of the legwork. But the fact that, like, neither of them had an EpiPen for their daughter, even though they know she has an allergy that must be bad enough that she needs an EpiPen.
Yep.
But then Charlie was forced to go to that party where she ate nuts and died. And that is nobody's fault except those parents' fault.
Nope.
And Charlie didn't even want to go. And so I love, like... The thing for me about that scene that really gets to me is, like, they're all sitting down. Steve has spent all day cooking this wonderful dinner, right? And when, like, he goes up to get Annie and she's like, "I'm cooking dinner." And he's like, "No, I already cooked the fucking dinner. Either come down or don't. I don't give a shit," right? Like, I'm fucking done trying at this point.
Yeah.
And they're all sitting down, they're eating, and Peter and Steve are, like, trying to have a good time. And Annie's just sitting there just, like, fucking... just like picking at her one piece of salad, right? And just, and is even like making faces when Peter's like, this is really good, Dad, like, thanks. And she's just like, and that's when Peter's like, is there something wrong, like, do you want to say something? And she's like, no, why would I want to say anything? So you can sneer at me again.
Yeah.
He's like, "What? I don't ever sneer at you." And that's when, like,
yeah,
she's like, "Well, what do you want me to do? You want me to release you?" He's like, "Yes, fine. Fucking release me." And then she, like, goes into her tirade.
Yeah. And that scene, it is one of those ones where you're instantly transported into those just horrific family conversations.
Yes. Where,
and you feel so uncomfortable watching it.
So uncomfortable.
And the first few times I watched it, I was definitely in that uncomfortable space.
Yeah.
And now I'm just like, oh my God, this is one of my favorite scenes in cinema. I'm so excited.
And they all acted it so good.
Yeah.
And I love the aftermath of that scene too, of, like, you know, Annie like freaks out and she sits down and she's like huffing, still picking at that one piece of salad, right? And poor Peter, you know, Peter kind of, like, he stops eating, right? And he looks up and he just says, "What about you, Mom? You made her go to the party."
Yup.
"She didn't want to go."
Yup.
And I love it when Steve's like, "Okay, we're stopping this. We're stopping this right now. I put an end to it."
Yeah.
"Cut it out." And, like, you see Annie and she's just like, he's like, "I said, stop it. Fucking stop it." And she gets up and she's like, "Fine." She leaves.
He's like squirting her with water.
Yeah. Yeah. Stop. And I, like, the heartbreaking part for me is after she storms off and Peter doesn't do anything. He's still sitting there shell-shocked. And Dad, like, starts to try and eat again, and then he leans over and he touches Peter's hand like in an apologetic gesture.
Yeah.
And then he tries to eat, and then he just fucking can't. He's just like, God damn it.
Yep.
Like, I tried so hard.
You ruined this perfect dinner.
And, you know, it's like, it's all fucked. Because, like, yeah,
yep.
Peter shouldn't have tried to drive Charlie when he was literally 10 sheets to the wind fucking high. But, like, that was literally not his cross to bear.
Yeah. And just trying to, like, draw some parallels from my personal experience. Like, I have celiac disease. If I go out to a friend's place or anything like that, I have to be careful about what I eat, mm-hmm. if I eat at all.
Yeah.
If somebody has a nut allergy, especially one that leads to anaphylaxis, that's another level of awareness that they need to have.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be offered anything. You never know what's being made. You never know, even if the food itself doesn't contain any like nut material in it, you never even know if it's like the ingredients are created on shared belts that have nuts. And Absolutely. Most nut allergies, you have to be that heightened.
Yeah.
When you have to be diligent about what you're using.
And yeah. And if you know you're sending out a young child who doesn't, they just don't know to ask about those things, like they shouldn't be on their own. Or like you should at least have talks with them where you're like, hey, these are the things you can eat. You literally would have to bring your own food, which sucks, but like it's the safe thing to do. Two, you should have an EpiPen.
Yeah.
People should know how to fucking use it. Peter should have known how to use an EpiPen, should have known what to do, you know, right? And there were plenty of people at that party too that like,
yeah,
maybe they had an EpiPen. Maybe somebody could have called the police or an ambulance or whatever, right? Like it's a woulda, coulda, shoulda type of scenario in terms of this movie, but like, that's what is funny about this confrontation scene at dinner. It's like Annie is treating Peter like he's the worst piece of shit on earth because he won't apologize for killing his sister when she needs to take some accountability and responsibility for the fact that she's kind of a bad mom.
Yeah. Yeah. If nothing else, there should always be an EpiPen in that car. If not on their person, it should be in the vehicle that drives the family.
Right. Right. And like, I get it. EpiPens are expensive.
Yeah.
I get it. Like they're expensive, but are they more expensive than your child's life? Because if you look at my later scariest scene,
yeah,
I would think it was worth the $700 or whatever an EpiPen is.
Yeah. Especially since it's not like they're a downtrodden family. Like they have an affluent amount of money. They obviously live in a very nice house.
Fucking afford they an have EpiPen. Very nice You're things. Telling me that they just chose not to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's and what I'm, you're telling me.
I'm fairly certain, I think Novum mentioned it in the video, I'm fairly certain that Steve is like a psychiatrist or something like that. Like, you know they have good health insurance. They can get a fucking EpiPen.
Yeah. Yeah. Plot hole podcast. Anyways, Jesus fucking Christ. Other honorable mentions that I had, I fucking love all the symbols.
Yeah.
In this movie, like the fucking Satan-y Zazas and then Lifthoch Pandemonium are written in various places throughout the house. For what I found, they're just supposed to be invocations of Paimon. They're just like the further solidify, like having Paimon slowly infiltrating their house and infiltrating their lives, because they're written like over people's beds and shit.
Yeah. This movie is rife with symbolism.
Yeah.
It is everywhere.
Yeah. Let me see. I also, one of my questions is, I was wondering why Paimon likes chocolate. Do you notice that, like, Charlie's eating chocolate, well, for, you know.
Yeah.
Her screen time.
I don't really know. I don't know if that's something that's, like, Paimon specific.
Right.
Or if that's something that's Charlie specific.
Well, because I remember an interview with Ari Aster where he says that Charlie doesn't exist. When Charlie was born, Ellen put Paimon in Charlie's body.
Yeah.
And so there's never been a Charlie. It's always been Paimon.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because then when Peter becomes Paimon at the end, Joanie calls him Charlie.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because Charlie lives in Paimon for whatever reason, but
yeah. Oh yeah. Because then there's also the moment where they, have the fucking candle Zuka, and Charlie is actually present, and you find out that like Charlie has never been there.
Mm-hmm.
like is like, who yeah. are these people?
Who are these
like,
people?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of curious how a lot of the paranormal stuff happened in their house. Cause yeah. I kind of figured there was like, it was like hypnotism and then also the cult
yeah.
that were like working, doing things in the background.
I'll Google really quick to see if chocolate is a payment thing or.
I was just curious. Cause like, I just noticed like she's always either chewing a chocolate bar or she's eating M&Ms or like. Like chocolate was obviously something that Payman really liked.
This is from the Hereditary subreddit. And somebody had asked, what's up with Payman eating chocolate? I watched Hereditary for the second time yesterday and I loved it. But one thing still bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Charlie / Payman eating chocolate in almost all of Charlie's scenes? Top comment says, this comes up every once in a while, but the only thing that we've found is a proverb that says chocolate is the devil's food.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to know. I love that. I love that.
Love Reddit.
All right. That's all of my honorable mentions for favorite. My favorite scene of this movie is when Peter has holed himself up in the attic to hide from some scary thing that's right outside. And he gets up and he kind of feels something really weird. And he looks to his left and he just sees like four naked people just standing there. And they're just like... And he goes, and he just jumps out the window.
Yeah. And, you know, a callback to our last episode, it was a little refreshing to see four naked people just standing there and a witch not shaming a penis.
Right.
Yeah.
Them not being like,
with a hook.
So, yeah, that was it for me for favorites.
So for my favorites, Annie's monologue at the kitchen table was my first honorable mention.
Yeah.
My second honorable mention is when Annie goes over to Joan's house and they have the summoning of Joan's grandchild.
Right.
And it's not that scene itself. It's after that scene. Joan has then given Annie the ritual and said, you just need to make sure that your entire family is in the house, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And as Annie's about to leave, there's a shot where you see a profile of Toni Collette, and then in the mirror you can see the reflection of Joan. And
yeah,
when I watched this scene the first time, I was just like, oh, that's just a really cool shot. When I watched it again with you, mm-hmm. I thought a little bit more into it, and all throughout this movie there are scenes where there are people that are standing kind of in the background or out a window or in random spots to show you that like the cult is always watching this family.
Yeah.
And I think that was Ari Aster giving it away of like, now pay attention, look through those spaces because there's always somebody there.
Yeah.
And that I was like, that's so fucking cool.
Yeah. Like, it's such a neat little detail because then when you do watch it again, you do start to pick it up.
Yeah. And then my favorite scene, which is actually my favorite scene in all of cinema, like hands down, easily my favorite scene, is the moment where Peter is up in his room and he's still in shock from the fact that his sister's head just popped off in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And the night has gone by. It's morning time. And the frame is entirely on Peter's face through the duration of this scene.
Right.
But what you hear in the background is Annie saying that she's going to take the car. I think she's going to run an errand.
She's going to get balsam wood.
Yeah, she's going to get balsam wood.
I'll be back in 20.
Yeah, I'll be back in 20. And you hear her go down, open the car door, and then you hear just what is honestly the most accurate portrayal I could possibly imagine of a mom finding their dead child.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
The way that you don't see that, but you feel every bit of that while just seeing Peter's face. Remarkable.
Oh, definitely.
Like, that is it, to me, that is what cinema is. Yeah. Is like, you don't even have to see it. We made you feel it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I like how, just to add on to that scene, that was one of my honorable mentions for scariest, is it goes, it's on Peter's face. You hear Annie's initial reaction of finding Charlie, and then it goes from his face to Charlie's head on the highway. And it's like, it's fucking covered in ants, you know, like part of her jaw is severed. One of her eyes is like swollen shut from the anaphylaxis. Like, it's fucking gnarly.
It is.
And it's button ended. It's like bookended by this scene of there's like a stormy night. You can see like lightning flashes and then you can hear thunder. And it's Annie just fucking losing it on the floor, just like rocking back and forth, just saying like, I just want to die. I can't handle it. I can't do this. Like, Charlie and Steve's just trying to comfort her while she's going through this. And it pans from them in the doorway to the hallway where Peter's just standing there.
Yeah. This, for being a horror movie, this movie is emotionally gut-wrenching.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have another scene for you because it's not in my honorable mentions for scariest, but it is one that I bring up. It comes a little bit later. It's one of the nights that Annie is going to go out to go to like grieving counseling, right? Mm-hmm. And so she's probably come home from work or whatever errand, and she's literally just like fucking sitting in the car, right? And you don't notice this at first because you're watching from Peter's perspective, and he comes home and he puts his bike down. And then we notice as he rides by that Annie's sitting in the driver's seat in the car, and it goes to her perspective. And there's this heartbreaking moment where Peter puts his bike down and he's standing in front of the front door and he's just quivering and he looks like he's about to cry. And he, like, you can tell in his brain, he's like, I don't want to go inside because I don't feel safe in my house. And like, my mom hates me and like all of these things that like, you're just imagining him thinking. And he, you know, just eventually he just kind of like, you know, gets his big boy face on and then walks in the door. And the moment he leaves, she turns the car on and leaves.
Yeah.
And that was like a very realistic scene to me of just the, again, this like family dynamic.
Mm-hmm. This whole movie, like if you are somebody who comes from any family trauma, this movie is going to trigger you, but it's also going to be so satisfying in a way.
Yeah, validating.
So, yeah, validating. And then you're just like, okay, it's not just me.
Mm-hmm.
Like this kind of thing is...
It is very accurate.
Yeah, even though this is a fictional portrayal of this.
Yeah.
Like, it is very accurate. It is very affirming to be like, yeah, I've felt that.
I felt that. Oh, yeah. Or like it has a very good portrayal of mental illness, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, every family, I feel like almost every family has some kind of mental illness that's going on that really goes unchecked for a long time. And or that people don't want to talk about it because it's hard to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shall we get into scariest?
We shall.
I have a lot. I feel like I have more honorable mentions for scariest than I did for favorite.
I've taken a new strategy with my notes where I only give myself maximum two honorable mentions and then my favorite. And so it's making me be really decisive.
I like it.
And
though,
as somebody with ADHD, being decisive, don't not like my forte. Nope. Mm-mm. But I'm doing it.
All right then. Well, my first honorable mention is I really liked Peter's first nightmare that he has.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's his first one. It's one of the nightmares that he has where he wakes up and he thinks he sees Charlie in the corner. And he kind of goes, Charlie? And she looks like mortified. Like, and then all of a sudden her mouth kind of like slowly drops open and her head falls off. And when it rolls closer to him, it turns into a ball.
Yeah.
And right after that is when he gets pulled back into bed and all the hands are like grabbing at his head and like tugging on his head.
Yeah.
So I had that as one of my honorable mentions for sure.
Absolutely.
I did also have, let me see here. I had Charlie's death in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not only Annie's reaction, but also Peter's reaction.
Yeah.
Like when he's trying. So, I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into this scene, but I'll just do it really quickly. Charlie and Peter go to like a little party, like a little high school party. And Peter wants to go hang out with this girl that he really likes, but he doesn't want Charlie to be there. So he tells her to like, hey, why don't you go hang out over there? Oh, look, they're giving out chocolate cake. He's completely oblivious to the fact that it definitely has nuts in it. And he says, I'll be right back and then we can hang out. I'll be back in like 20 minutes. And he leaves her. He goes into another room. He's brought a bunch of weed. So they're all smoking weed. And Charlie eats the cake and very quickly starts having an anaphylactic reaction. And she tries
She just sit when we were watching it, and she's sitting there making her little toy, and she's wheezing, like literally made my heart drop. She tries to fix it with water, but it's not helping. And so she goes in to get Peter right as he's finishing a huge fucking bong rip.
Yeah.
And he looks up and he's like, "Hey, Charlie, what's up?" And she's sitting there wheezing, and he's like, "Are you okay? What's wrong?" And she says, "I think my throat's getting bigger. Like it's hard to breathe." And so then the next scene, he's just picks her up. He's like carrying her. He's running to the car and he drives off. He's trying to get there, but she's thrashing in the backseat, like suffocating to death. And so he just floors it. She sticks her head out the window to get air, and he sees a deer in the road and swerves, and her head gets decapitated on a fucking telephone pole. Just, oh, the sound it fucking makes is gnarly.
It's so good. Gnarly. So bad, so good.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, Peter slams on the brakes. And it has this really great moment where he kind of stops for a second, and he goes to look in the rearview mirror, and it kind of has like this shaky cam moment of him like panning up to the rearview mirror. And then he like doesn't, he just keeps looking at the road. And then he says, "You okay? Yeah, you're okay. Okay." And then he just lets his foot off the brake and he just cruises home.
Yeah.
And he goes all the way home and he parks. He doesn't park in a parking spot. He just parks the car, turns it off. Gets out, goes inside, and then his fucking parents go, oh, thank God, they're home. I'm not going to go check for signs of life or anything, no. But, like, they're definitely home. Charlie sleeps out in the fucking treehouse half the time anyway, so, like, it's not unusual that only one set of footsteps came in or whatever.
Yeah.
But he just literally goes, and he just lays in bed and goes to sleep.
That portrayal of shock where you hear him tell himself, "Yeah, you're okay." But then you see how slowly he starts driving home, where you know he knows.
But what are you going to do about it?
He's just like, what do I do?
What do I do?
I just got to get home.
You're going to go pick her fucking head up off the ground, right? Yeah. Like, and I love that moment of him, like, his curiosity. He wanted to look at the rear, at the back seat, but then he was like, don't.
Yeah,
like, you know, you don't want to know what's back there.
No. No, and he knows he can't hear her anymore. And yeah, that's... And the callback to that scene, too, that happens later on when he goes to smoke with his friends, and he's like, "I think my throat's getting bigger."
Yeah, and he has, like, a little panic attack. Oh, my God, that was such a sad scene.
And then I also want to bring up, in the party scene, specifically when they're, like, chopping up the nuts to make this cake, one of the things that... Novum also put in their video was that this is indicative of all of their surrounding people being part of this cult. Because what teenage party do you ever go to where somebody is home making a cake, first off, let alone while the people are there? And there is certain color indications of this is cult, this is payment, this is this.
Interesting.
And they signify that, like, it's a blue or something that's supposed to signify payment, and it's a red, I believe, that's supposed to signify cult.
Interesting.
And every one of the friends that's at this party has something red on. I think that's what the thing is.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I like that.
I'll have to go back through and make sure that the colors that I'm saying are accurate, but I'm pretty sure that that's what the color scheme is.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that a lot, honestly.
And so they think that the friends were initiating Charlie's death.
Yeah. Well, they were just setting the pieces in motion, right? They're like just setting the events in motion. I like that.
Yeah.
Other honorable mentions that I have, I won't really get into like the scenes, but like Peter, when he broke his nose, was pretty incredible. And I have some fun trivia about that. Steve's death was also very interesting. And briefly touching on it, I do also like that Annie kind of has a very different theory, where because of all of these things happening and because of her relationship with Joan, she starts to think that their house is possessed by some sort of spirit that wants to hurt Peter because she did this seance where she summoned Charlie.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with like the whole cult situation thing. I think that just leaves my scariest.
I'm so excited to hear it. I don't have any idea what it could be. But I'm curious if we might have a similar one.
Well, mine is, so it's a bit of a two-parter just because like it's kind of one continuous scene. It's Peter gets knocked out after he breaks his nose. His dad brings him home and he gets put upstairs into bed. And then Annie like tells dad about dead mom who's in the attic. And she's also telling him about how there's this book, Charlie's sketchbook, that like they have to burn it because this is the only, like, she's found a bunch of pictures of Peter and he's in danger and like they have to get rid of the book. But she tried to get rid of the book earlier and she got lit on fire when she tried to throw it in the fire. So she claims to Steve, like, you have to do it. And when you do it, it's going to take me too. And he doesn't believe her. And they throw it in the fire and he gets lit up like a Roman candle and dies. So it's right after that, a little bit further after that point, Peter wakes up and he has a raging headache and it's dark out. And he's like, Mom, Dad? And you just see fucking Annie in the fucking corner of the room. Just like hanging out there. And so I like that. That's kind of a slight honorable mention. But when Peter gets up and he walks around the house, she leaves, right? And you see her when he finds Dad in the living room, all torched, and he's like looking at her. And you see Annie, and she's like behind him in the ceiling. And Peter goes to turn around because he hears something. He hears a creak, and he turns around and he sees that naked dude just standing in the doorway.
Yeah.
And he's just like, what the fuck? And then Annie just is all of a sudden on the other side of the room, and he turns and he makes eye contact with her, and she just starts chasing him.
Yeah.
That's my scariest fucking scene. Yeah. It's just him making eye contact with Annie, and then just like they have that very brunt like musical cue too, and then she just fucking just starts tearing ass after him.
Yeah.
And then like chases him up into the attic. He pulls the thing closed and he immediately starts hearing her banging on the like door
with her fucking
head. And that's the end of the scene for me, is when he's like, mommy, please stop. You're scaring me. Stop. And you just see her just fucking like banging her head against it over and over again.
That's one of my honorable mentions, was Annie headbutting the attic door from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that effect is pretty cool.
And just to kind of expand on that a little bit too, one of the reasons why this is such a highly regarded horror movie is there have been a lot of people who have made the statement that this movie takes all of the things that you would expect from a horror movie, all of the tropes that have been overplayed, all of the different effects that have been overplayed, and it executes them in such a perfect way that it's like, okay, now we're done with these. Nobody is ever going to do it better than this movie did.
Definitely.
We can lay these to rest. And I'm like, yeah.
It did a really, really phenomenal job, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah. Annie headbutting the attic door was one of my honorable mentions. Annie's fun little decapitation moment is in my honorable mentions.
Honestly, so, that's a good. Yeah. That's a good honorable mention.
So not far after the headbutting the attic situation. Peter ends up in the attic and Annie ends up in the attic as well, somehow. Yeah. And Peter looks up and he just sees Annie with, I think it's like piano wire.
It's piano wire.
Yeah. Sees Annie with piano wire just seesawing back and forth on her own neck.
On her own neck.
Trying to just working on cutting her head off.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see much. It's a very dark scene, but it's equal parts scary and kind of comical.
It is a bit
to
funny.
See it at the same time.
Yeah.
And I love when comedy and horror merge like that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Although I will say it is kind of scary the way she's fucking staring daggers at him.
Yeah.
Like that was kind of terrifying.
And then I had a tie for my favorite and my other honorable mention.
For your scariest and honorable mention?
Or for my scariest and my honorable mention. The sleepwalking scene with Annie going into Peter's room and having almost a forgiveness moment.
Yes.
Almost a forgiveness moment. But then you recognize that like something's not quite right with the feel of this moment.
Right.
And I'm not going to go into all of the details of it, but you learn that this is a dream. And then you see that Annie is dousing them in gasoline or lighter
paint
fluid.
Paint thinner.
Yeah. Dousing them in paint thinner. And you suddenly hear Peter say, "Why are we wet?" And then you see Annie light on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh, shit, now Peter's gone too. But then you learn that that was a dream.
It was a dream. Right?
Yeah. But yeah. It also indicates that Annie has a history of sleepwalking, which you don't really know up until that point.
Well, yeah. And there is a bit of it's a tie-in too, because there is a moment where she's talking. I think she's talking to Joan about like how she hasn't had a good relationship with Peter and Charlie for that matter for a long time because of that one sleepwalking incident where she woke up having already covered them all in paint thinner and she was holding a lit match and she woke up to like the children screaming at her and so she was like, but I didn't light it. So like, what's the big deal? And so what's funny about the sleepwalking incident that she has and that what I really appreciate it is like, yeah, they're having this back and forth seems fairly normal, but then all of a sudden they start physically becoming more wet.
Yeah.
And then like Annie just starts getting like upset and then they light on fire. And so it's just this really interesting moment of like, you're back in that memory.
Yeah.
That she described earlier.
And it's ripping at your heartstrings too, because there is that like, oh my gosh, they're finally having a resolution. Like there's finally some forgiveness that's happening. And that then you're like, wait, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Oh, it was a fucking dream. Yeah. No.
Where it's
absolutely.
Like, oh my gosh, yes, they're healing. Why are they wet? What?
Why are they wet?
Fuck.
Oh, fuck. She was dreaming.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And then the thing that's tied with for my scariest scene is I just wrote, poor Peter. He's just trying to get an education. When he's in the classroom, well, he's trying as much as a teenage boy normally does.
Yeah, right.
But when he's in the classroom and you can tell that he's still totally checked out, like he is in the thick of his grief and he looks over into the reflection. I think it's like a cabinet or something looking at, but he looks over and as he's looking over, his reflection of course does the same,
mm-hmm.
but then his reflection just gets the most demonic smile on its face. And then he like, he audibly like shouts for a second. And then the teacher, I think just like calls his name or something. He's like, Peter, like, is everything okay? And that's right before he starts smashing his face into the desk.
I think that's a time beforehand. There's a couple of times beforehand where he just doesn't feel good in class. And like when he just looks at himself in the mirror, that's just like a regular shot. It was another time when he just physically didn't feel good.
Yeah.
And then I don't think he saw anything. He just had that moment where like his hand raised up.
Oh, yeah.
And it looked like he was having a stroke.
Yeah.
And apparently most of that was physically acted.
Yeah, you're right. Those are two separate scenes.
Because there's like tension building scenes.
Yeah.
And like he has that whole moment where he's like at lunch and he hears Joni shouting at him, Peter.
Yeah.
You know, and she says, Zagtany, Dagony, and Paragon.
I think if I'm going to pick between the two of them, the sleepwalking scene will be my scariest one.
Yeah.
Because I love that it does fuck with your heart at the same time.
It does. Like, it fucks with your heart. It calls back that earlier memory that she gave.
Yeah.
Right. And like, yeah. It's a really good scene. And then I kind of like that it ends with like her waking up. Because And I like how it seems like she isn't the only one who's having nightmares either. There's several times that she wakes up Peter and he's in the midst of having a nightmare. And he even says it when he wakes up. So.
Yeah.
Which is all probably just a part of the plan, right?
Yeah. Yeah, trying to whittle them down mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fuck.
I think that's it.
I think that's it.
We should do trivia. I'm looking through my notes just to see if there's anything else. Oh, fuck Grandma's letter.
Yeah.
Grandma's letter that she left in that little invocations.
Yeah.
This is a scene that like I did not notice the first time we watched this. I noticed it the second time. I forgot to bring it up in my honorable mentions for scariest, but it was when Annie is looking through her mom's stuff and she finds those notebooks and she finds like the thing on payment and stuff like that. Right. One of the things that she finds is a letter from her mom. And I wish I could pull it up for you, but it just says something like, my dearest Annie, I'm so sorry that I've done this. Like, I'm so sorry for your losses. But just know that like, our rewards will pale in comparison to the things that you're going to sacrifice or whatever.
Yeah.
And then like your dearest mommy or whatever. And so it's this very ominous, very like, it's ominous and also kind of almost like threatening, like a threatening letter to get. But then after she leaves, she's about to leave, right? She's like, oh, I don't like this. She puts it all away and she goes to leave and she turns off the light and she looks up and she just sees her mom.
Yeah.
Standing in the room and she just looks like she's just smiling. Like she's just been there this whole time. Oh. And Annie's just like, mom? And she flicks the light on and she's gone. That fucking actually made me jump a little bit.
That note too, because there's so many ways that you can take it where it can be foreshadowing. There is still more loss that you're going to experience before we get to our riches in this scenario. Or it could be Annie being like, oh, this is why all of this stuff has happened. And it's that bitch's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on not calling women, whether they're good or bad bitches. But if I were to be the kind of person to call a woman a bitch that is evil, then I would say it about Ellen.
She's sacrificing multiple generations of people. I think she deserves to be called a bitch.
Yeah, she deserves to be called worse.
But riches in hell.
Yeah, in hell. Where are you going to spend that money,
where
girl?
Where are you spending that at, like, H&M in hell?
Yeah.
Is that, where you're going to use all your gold doubloons for?
That would be the brand that's in hell. Yeah, I just love how like multi-layered that part is.
That cake is.
Yeah.
All right, I'm pulling up trivia. And then I have a weapons roster.
I'm excited about my weapon.
At around an hour and 35 minutes, in an interview, Alex Wolff, who plays Peter, explained that he wanted to actually break his own nose for the scene where his character slams his head into a desk. Director Ari Aster respectfully declined that offer and told Wolff they'd give him a soft, cushioned desk for the scene. When it was time for the scene to be shot, Wolf slams his head into the desk only to discover that the top was foam and the bottom was hard. He dislocated his jaw, which is a previous injury the actor had had for the scene. But I just love, like, Ari Aster in an interview was just like, yeah, we weren't going to do that because, like, no, right?
Yeah.
So we wanted to give him something that, like, would protect him, but we failed to think about the fact that, like, underneath the foam pad was a solid wooden desk.
Yeah.
So, like, it wasn't enough padding.
And yeah, you can't put enough and make it look realistic. So
you would just need to do a cutaway.
Yeah. Or you would have to like make the pad fully green and find a way to somehow CGI the depth
the
of that.
Depth.
Yeah.
Crazier things have been done, I'm sure.
True. Very true. I mean, we've covered crazier things.
It's true. Right? Ari Aster wanted to go for scares that were emotionally justified rather than solely leaning on traditional horror jump scares.
Yeah, that checks out. Most of the things that I found scariest in this film were also ripping at your heartstrings at the same time.
Yes. During the support meeting, Annie recounts her brother's suicide at age 16 and states that his suicide note blamed their mother for putting people inside him. Although Annie chalks this up to his schizophrenia, it could very well be that Ellen had originally attempted to conjure Payman through her own son. His death and her failure to summon Payman would then explain why Ellen put so much pressure on Annie to have children and why Charlie stated early on in the film that her grandmother always wished she was a boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And grandma fucking tit fed.
That was weird as fuck to me.
Yeah.
There's no way you could breastfeed your grandchild.
Unless it's sweet, sweet demon milk.
Unless it's powdered.
Ugh.
And you're mixing it with your own water.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of that white chicks. Yep. Your mom's so old. Breast milk's powder. You breastfeed like this.
You mean when we all very first got to hear Terry Crews's iconic song? Yeah. 1,000 Miles by Terry Crews.
I love this song. And for the lady, perhaps a salad. Perhaps not. Good fucking God. You got my ADHD brain going now.
And now that can call back to fucking The Exorcism of Emily Rose because Tina the Talking Tummy.
I can't even wear a short skirt and a top without looking like a fat pig. Ari Aster requested that Alex Wolff and Millie Shapiro go out to eat in character a few times, and they would sit for up to 3 hours in silence while Millie wouldn't speak and Alex would try to get her to talk.
Oh, I love that.
According to Alex Wolff, the original cut of the film could have easily pushed over 3 hours. The cut footage mostly consisted of more family dialogue.
Okay.
Do-do-do-do.
I kind of think the way that they reduced the family dialogue as much as possible. Like they kind of took the opposite approach.
Yeah.
Where they could have really overplayed the family dynamics, or they could have shown you exactly what that family dynamic was by not having them communicate much at all.
Right.
Makes it even better.
Right. No, I agree with you. With Hereditary, Ari Aster wanted to make a film about suffering that took suffering seriously.
Yeah.
This one we knew, but I think it's important to highlight here. At around 28 minutes, when Peter and Charlie are on their way to the party, the cult's logo can be seen carved into the pole that later decapitates Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And it like very specifically stays on that shot for a second.
Yeah.
Ari Aster liked Utah for the film because he thought its mountains were beautiful and breathtaking, but also menacing and ominous.
Good old Utah.
Director cameo by Ari Aster. At around an hour, 23 minutes, the voice on the phone calling Annie about her exhibit date at the Archer Gallery.
Mm.
Who leaves her a voicemail, I'm pretty sure. Hereditary's advertising campaign has been credited for keeping Charlie's death a secret from viewers, notably by showing Millie Shapiro prominently in the trailer, even though Charlie is alive for only about a quarter of the film. This deliberate mislead is similar to the horror classic Psycho, where Janet Leigh was made to look like the star of the film, only to be murdered one third of the way through.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually surprised when we rewatched it that I had put Charlie's death way earlier in the timeline, even. Like, I was like, oh yeah, like,
oh,
starts
she dies
and she
immediately
dies.
Yeah,
yeah, but there's a bit before that.
There's quite a bit beforehand.
Yeah.
At around an hour 20 minutes throughout the film, several words can be seen scrawled on the walls. At one point there are two words, Liftoach Pandemonium. Liftoach is an English transliteration of the Hebrew word to open. Pandemonium is Latin for all demons and is what Satan names hell in John Milton's Paradise Lost.
I actually just bought Paradise Lost, and that's on my short list for my TBR.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. This is what I was trying to state earlier. One way that Ari Aster pitched the film when he was first taking it out was, it's a story about a long-lived possession ritual told from the perspective of the sacrificial lamb.
Nice.
Ooh, this one's kind of fun. Around 1 hour, 55 minutes, Toni Collette wore a prosthetic neck and used a piano string for the scene where she saws her head off. Although some believe it is a wire saw, which is a common tool for backpackers, it is actually meant to be piano wire. The destroyed piano can be seen knocked over and broken after Peter runs down the stairs near the end of the movie.
Hell yeah.
Oh, here, I'll end with this one. At the end, when the life-size figurine of the demon Payman is shown, the fingers of its right hand are positioned in a way that Jesus is often portrayed as doing in medieval paintings. Pointer finger and middle finger out and together, other two fingers curled in a fist, and thumb parallel but slightly curved. But on Payman, he's holding it upside down. The medieval and ancient hand gesture is used as a representation of Jesus, so like crosses being inverted, Payman is using this to disrespect Jesus. Also, Payman is wearing a halo with rays coming out of it like a sun. This halo is also seen in depictions of Jesus, thus meaning those worshiping Payman believe he is the true savior.
Mm.
That's pretty cool. I did not know that.
Yeah, giving you those afterlife riches, just like the promise of the pearly gates.
Uh-huh, right?
Yeah.
Right? Weapons roster.
Yeah.
I have fire.
Mm-hmm.
Also a notebook. Pole.
Pole.
Telephone pole.
Pole.
Scissors.
Mm-hmm.
A window.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolate cake.
Mm-hmm.
A car.
Mm-hmm.
A school desk.
Mm-hmm.
And piano wire.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think the only other one that I had was neglect.
Child neglect and abuse.
Yep.
Yep. I think for me, I personally was going to go with piano wire.
Oh, sick. Good.
Yeah. Was that what you were doing too?
No.
Oh, nice. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, it's okay. My rating, quality, I give this a 5 out of 5.
Nice.
So much detail. It's a very wild ride from start to finish. The ending is shocking. And I also really love the cinematography in this. Like the amount of times that they have those like day to night shots are just fucking impeccable.
Yeah.
It completely matches this vibe of like just time just like fucking flying by, especially when you're grieving and you just like feel like you don't ever get a break from the grief.
It's like time flying by while simultaneously dragging on.
Yes.
And it's like, yes. Yeah, it portrays it very well.
Yes, that's such a great way to put it. For scariness, I gave it a 3 out of 5, mm-hmm. Can of Wires. I think it's existentially scary. I think Annie's definitely scary in the end when she's chasing Peter around. But I find it more unsettling.
Yeah.
One thing that I really do like about it is it kind of makes you feel like you also live in a family that has like skeletons in the closet.
Yeah.
And then finally for rewatchability, I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. It's not one of my favorite movies. It's not one that like, if I were to pick a movie, I don't know that Hereditary would be on my short list. But I feel like it has so many details and so many Easter eggs that it warrants at least a second watch, if yeah. not a third watch.
Yeah. Agreed. So for my weapon, I chose outdated telecommunications infrastructure because we don't need telephone poles anymore. Yeah. So for quality, I also gave it a 5 out of 5 for exactly the same reasons that you mentioned. This movie, as well as Midsommar, actually solidify Ari Aster as my favorite director. Easily. The amount of detail that he puts in things
mm-hmm.
Is comparable, if not superior, to all of the most highly regarded directors in history.
Oh, definitely.
And I think that we've seen just the beginning of what he is capable of.
Oh, absolutely. There is one trivia point that I will bring up just because you said that Ari Aster always creates like backstories and autobiographies for every character for his films.
Hell yeah.
And they're not like a one page reference sheet. Yeah. Sometimes they are very extensive because it helps him shape what happens to that character.
I think in the past, you know, we've seen the really iconic horror directors like Hitchcock and then like Kubrick, who was the first person to really put like iconography in things and really put symbolism as a heavy thing in his film.
Sure.
And Ari Aster is like taking all of those together and wrapping them and putting a bow on it mm-hmm. and being like, let me show you how to do this
the right way.
Contemporarily.
Definitely.
Using all of the tools that we have available. And I think that's one of the reasons why it brought it up for me. There is no ding on quality in this. And any plot holes that we can find, I think there's an explanation for it. Like, even with them not having an EpiPen and that sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
she didn't give a shit about her kids.
Yeah, right?
So, like...
right?
Yeah.
Obviously not. Or, like, I don't know, maybe they'd only ever had an anaphylactic experience one time.
Yeah.
But it is... Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, not a whole lot of plot holes. That would really be the only one. But, like, if you have to have a one gimme of, like, we just didn't have enough time to go pick up the EpiPen,
yeah,
I'll give it to you.
One in a over 2-hour movie versus, like, you and I have watched hour and 15 to hour and a half movies and been like, there's 16 things here that don't make sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, quality 5 out of 5 outdated telecommunication infrastructures. For scariness, I gave it a 4 out of 5. I wouldn't say that this is like boo, kind of scary.
No.
But the reason why I bumped it up to a 4 is for that exact reason, that it's emotionally justified scares. And for me, I have a bigger reaction to a movie that is toying with my emotions than I do with one that's just trying to scare me.
Yeah.
And I felt like this movie was making it personal. And I'm like, all right, then.
It makes it scarier.
Yeah.
It does make it scarier than if it were to be something that was just like trying to physically shock you.
Yeah.
Like a Hostel, right? Or like something like that. Or something that was trying to be super paranormal, like a Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Cause Paranormal Activity, like, you go into it knowing, like, at least before they started making a ton of them and trying to go really far into backstory and all that kind of bullshit,
mm-hmm.
you go into that movie just thinking, I'm just going to get scared. And that's the depth of it.
Definitely.
Like,
well, and I was thinking yeah. to myself that one of the things that's great about Hereditary is this kind of, not everybody's family lives in this cult where they're trying to resurrect demons, right?
Yeah.
But it's like very clearly telling this narrative of like every family has a secret. most families carry trauma through their future generations. And so I kind of like that as like, it's this realism layer as well as this, we're telling this like occultism story. And it also makes me think of like people that grow up in actual cults.
Yeah.
Right. Like Mormon cults or like LFDS or whatever.
Yeah.
Who, you know, they learn once they get older, like, oh fuck, I live in a cult, and then they escape and leave. But like for the longest time, they didn't realize that that was just their reality. That was their upbringing.
Yeah. So
that's what I like about this movie, is that duality of telling something that is very real. Trauma.
Yeah.
Secrets.
Yeah.
Shared like generational, like past trauma, as mm-hmm. well as like actual trauma that you're experiencing in real time.
Yeah.
As well as like telling this like not a superfluous narrative, but like a narrative that doesn't really happen to everybody.
Yeah.
Being in a cult where you're trying to resurrect some demon.
Yeah. Putting that metaphor sandwich with a paint job on it. That's like, this is going to be wild.
Yeah.
But this actually means this, this, and this, that are all things that really happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Fucking phenomenal.
And then rewatchability, I actually gave it a 5. And the reason why, I don't normally like movies that are over 2 hours long.
Right.
Like, I have a pretty hard stance that like an hour and a half is all you really need for a movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't find myself at any point in this movie thinking how much of this is left. I feel like I'm in it mm-hmm. the whole time. I do think that as far as contemporary horror goes, it is one of the best. And that's arguable, of course. This is my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think, kind of calling to that, like, if I were to make recommendations for people, I think that this is not only one of the most accessible and has a really broad audience that could enjoy it, but I think it really well highlights the things that I do love about horror.
Definitely.
And I think that it can get people that aren't really into the genre to think more critically about it.
Definitely.
Because I think, especially when I talk about horror books with people, a lot of the time I notice that people think that horror is just a gruesome story mm-hmm. and they don't know that it's commentary about things. Like, it can be political. It can be about grief. It can be, you know, X, Y, Z, all these different things.
Absolutely.
And this is one of those movies that it's like, yes, this is a scary movie. However, look at this through the lens of grief, or like, look at this through the lens of family dynamics.
Definitely.
And you can see, oh shit, horror is more than I thought.
Yeah.
And I really love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I'm glad you brought that up.
So I think, yeah, 5, 4, 5, outdated telecommunications infrastructures.
Hell yeah.
Yep. So what doing?
What doing? What have I been doing for the last week? I've been working like longer nights. Not working like super late into the night, but just getting home and like not really doing a whole lot. I started a couple of new books. I'm still working on Krampus by Brom, which is turning out to be very interesting. I'm kind of liking it because I don't know too much about the lore of Krampus, but it's kind of like, it's part Norse mythology. And then there's also like Krampus is trying to outfox Santa Claus. And he's also using this like, just like kind of low life Southern boy, who's just like kind of has like a kind of jack of all trades kind of skill set, and is just trying to like protect his daughter and his ex-wife. And he just kind of got wrapped up in all of this supernatural stuff with Krampus and Santa Claus. And so it's been interesting so far.
Yeah.
It's been very interesting. So I'll let you know how it is. I really liked The Child Thief by Brom. So
yeah.
I got this one. I also got The Child Thief. So I was going to listen to that one afterwards because I haven't listened to it in a minute. What else have I been doing? Honestly, not too much. Harrison and I have been climbing on Sundays. So like every Sunday we go rock climbing at our favorite gym down at Stoneworks. And that's been a lot of fun. It's really fun to do something active with Harrison, but then to also like he's been asking me for advice for how to climb these different routes. And because we're going to Stoneworks, they don't change the routes hardly ever. So we're just doing the same problems constantly, which
that's
is good,
cool.
Fun.
You get to see your progression then.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm trying to teach Harrison too, that like when we get in there and we're like, oh fuck, we've climbed this green one like three times and it's so easy at this point. I've been showing him these drills that I do where you can do the same route, but you just make it harder. So you just like only use one of your feet. And you can only flag or like smear with the other foot. And so it limits your availability of holds that you can use or like, you know, you're trying to climb something, but like you have to move your feet before you move your hands, right? You like do things like just make tiny minute changes to change the way that you're climbing.
Yeah.
But still using the same route essentially.
I can understand probably where Harrison's brain is because he's a weightlifter, so he is used to linear progression with everything.
Yes.
And so if the route's not getting harder, he doesn't feel like he's progressing.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's a good way for you to be like, all right, here's a way that you can work in a different variable.
Exactly.
And and it's kind of like up in the sets instead of up in the reps instead of up in the weight.
Exactly. Like, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's up in the reps for sure. Or just teaching you like different ways to use your body. Cause there's a lot of different ways you can climb the same route.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's been a lot of fun.
Now you got to do it backwards like Toni Collette.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
One thing you could do is you could just start down climbing, right? You like climb to the top and then you just start like down climbing until you can't anymore. But so we've been doing a lot of that. Other than that, I've just been working and playing games. I just kind of play a video game when I get home and then make dinner or whatnot.
Yeah.
What about you? What have you been doing?
So it's backpacking season, mm-hmm. right? Not that every season isn't backpacking season for me at this point.
You could go backpacking like, all year.
And I think I have.
At this point?
Yeah. I think in the last calendar year, I've gone every season. But I did a really fucking cool trail since the last time that we recorded called High Camp on Mount Adams.
Nice.
And we initially selected this trail because Jordan was like, hey, I want to do something a little less strenuous because I just moved. And then also I had a spontaneous work trip that took me to Alaska and back in 24 hours. And like, I just want to chill and go enjoy being up on the mountain.
Yeah.
And so I was like, sick, I'll look for something. And I'm looking through trails and I see one that's like a total of 8-point-something miles. And I'm like, easy. We're doing 2 nights. If we just go up, set up camp, we can even side quest while we're up there the second day, or we can spend a whole day just chilling up there and then the next day come back down.
Yeah.
And what the trail notes didn't tell me was that, yes, it's like 4.3 miles each direction.
Okay.
But the last 0.5 miles is where all of the elevation comes in. So the last 0.5 miles, we were literally like climbing up boulders, getting to a ridge that then the ridge was just scree in a path that's maybe a foot wide, if that, on the side of a fucking drop and loose rock. And so we're just going up it. We're like
carrying your packs.
Fuck
shit.
It. We're going to do it. Yeah.
Did you and say of it was course, called High Camp?
Yeah. And so, and of course, we both like hella overpacked because we were like, food. We're just going to bring a ton of food. And so we hella overpack. We're on this ridge. We're like,
we're going to die.
This is fucked, but we're going to do it. And so we get up. Once you get past that fucking V12 of a ridge, we get into the meadow that we're supposed to camp at. It's an alpine meadow. It's gorgeous. It's like right at the edge of where alpine meadow turns into alpine tundra.
Uh-huh.
And so it was gorgeous. We had views of the glaciers the entire time. You could hear the glacier activity all throughout the day. The place that we got water was like one of the few remaining snow fields that was just melting into this little creek.
Oh.
It was gorgeous. I like looking out the window of my tent or looking out the door of my tent, it was the summit of Mount Adams. And then when I got out of my tent, if I panned left, it was, you could see the Goat Rocks Wilderness.
Wow.
Pan a little further left, it was Mount Rainier. A little further left, it was St. Helens. Like, it was perfect. It was iconic Washington.
Yeah, I'm not leaving.
Yeah, it was So cool. And we did decide to side quest the second day. We went, there was a place that's called Glacier Lake. It was really fucking cool. There was supposed to be a trail. We saw cairns kind of sometimes. What you could call cairns. It was at least a rock stacked on another rock.
Sure.
But we kind of blazed our own trail through that, up over another fucking boulder scramble into this gorgeous, just like perfectly blue lake that was right at the edge of one of the main glaciers. And while we were sitting at the lake, part of the glacier cracked and fell into the water. Mm-hmm. And we got to experience like a little tsunami because like the water receded super fast and then bolted back up there. And we were like, fuck, we got to get up. Like
we were
sitting on rocks and we're like, oh shit. And just like went up a little bit and we're like, okay, we're good. But to be there when it happened, and we just like sat for another hour and a half trying to see if it was going to happen again.
Right.
And we could hear things start shifting, but I was just really happy that we got to see it.
That's so cool.
So that was kind of like the big overarching thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just prior to that, I had gone on a trail with Danny that was fucking cool too. I am so grateful that my brain is wired in a way that I find enjoyment.
Oh, that's something
this hobby.
Yeah. And that's something I got to bring up too. It's Danny.
I'm just so, yeah, I'm so happy.
I love hearing about your backpacking adventures.
It's the one thing in my life that I do that's kind of crazy shit.
No, it's fucking awesome shit. It's not crazy at all. It's awesome.
Yeah. Like I don't consider myself to be like an adrenaline junkie or anything like that. Like I don't do things that risk my life very regularly.
Sure.
But somehow I get put in situations backpacking that do risk my life fairly regularly.
But it's worth it.
And it's worth it.
It's worth it.
And then I just yesterday, or actually I'll start earlier in the week. Last Saturday, Nick wanted to go out on a date. He has recently gotten promoted. And so he like got his first paycheck.
Hell
and he's
yeah.
like, I want to take us out. And so we went out to Bamboo Sushi and got sushi. And then we went to Salt and Straw and got ice cream.
Oh.
And it was just a nice little day together. And then we had a recreation of our date last night with my friend Issa and his wife Chelsea, mm-hmm. who live in Arizona. They were up visiting.
That's
and
awesome.
So we got to go get Bamboo Sushi and go to Salt and Straw again. And we got to do it with them. And Nick hadn't met them yet. So it was cool to have them meet.
Right.
And Issa like Snapchatted me today and was like, it was so cool to meet Nick. He's such a cool guy. And it just makes me so happy when like my people love my people.
Yes, of course.
And that brings me into like, you got to meet Danny.
I got to meet Danny.
Like Danny is family. Like that is my brother right there. And I'm like, how have my brother and my sister not met? I don't understand. But yeah, we got to go out and have Thai and that was really fucking cool.
That was really fun. Yeah. I really liked that a lot, honestly.
Yeah. You two, of course, Mom and Nick also, but like you two, Chase, Mom and Nick are like the people that are the most integral to who I am as a human.
Yeah.
And it's so nice that now like everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could have a party.
Nobody's gotten to meet Chase yet. Arkansas is far.
Yeah.
But we'll make it happen.
One day, honestly.
Yeah.
I'd meet halfway.
Yeah, we'll make it happen.
We'll probably make our way over there at some point.
Yeah. The other just like small things, I read Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. That was rad as fuck. I don't like science fiction, but I like that book.
Yeah.
I finished East of Eden by Steinbeck.
Ooh.
That was also, that is a perfect story.
Hmm.
Like it spans like three generations of these families and it's a light retelling of the story of Cain and Abel.
Interesting.
And
okay.
it there's no way for me to put into words how remarkable this book is. Like I get why Steinbeck is regarded as one of the best authors.
Wow.
This was so fucking good. It was 600 pages that I never wanted to stop.
Wow.
Yeah. It was so good. And then I'm currently listening to, via recommendation from Chase, Dungeon Crawler Carl.
Oh yeah. Aunt Valerie's recommended that.
Yeah.
Book to me a couple times.
Really fucking funny.
Yeah. That's
like,
what I heard.
I was going to get the physical book and read it, but yeah. Chase was like, no, listen to it. And I'm glad that he made me listen to it.
Some books are better listened to.
They do a lot. Like the whole premise of this book is that it's the extraterrestrial takeover of Earth, mm-hmm. but the humans who live through the initial like big issue are put into like a alien game show, mm-hmm. and the game show is centered around them having to go through these different dungeons and beat things that are and so it's just this guy who like he's caught outside trying to catch a cat that had jumped out the window and like his boxers, a leather jacket and pink Crocs, and then he's in this dungeon and just has to like learn how to fight for his life. And the audiobook, they do different voices for everything, which is great, but then like the AI for the game show has like an AI filter on it. And it's so fucking funny. It like I did not know what to think with this, and I am thoroughly enjoying
it. Yeah. Because then like you're probably insinuating like that's what makes it such a fun audiobook. You wouldn't get the same experience if you read it.
No.
Right? Because you just read it all in the same voice and tone.
Yeah.
And timbre.
Yeah. But no, you get like almost like the Big Brother announcer in this story where it's like, you've unlocked this achievement.
Right.
And there's even one where it's like you've unlocked a bag of dicks chest or something like that. Like it's just stupid shit.
That's fucking awesome. Yeah. I love it.
It's highly recommend that.
Okay.
Highly recommend.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's everything. The only other things I've been doing is I've been playing, I actually am replaying Cosmic Wheel Sisterhood. I'm trying to go a little bit less of a pacifist route and a little bit more aggressive. So we'll see how that goes. But I just love how much variety there is in that game. Because it's kind of like a choose your own adventure. You know, and maybe partially not a dating sim, but like a sim where like you're just constantly talking to people and making decisions that then fragment into different butterfly effects. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm playing for the first time in months because I'm not gone on a Saturday. I'm playing Baldur's Gate with Chase on Saturday, and I'm so stoked.
Oh, fuck,
it's going to be cool to play it again.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, and to be able to hang out.
All right. Well, until next week.
Bye.
Have a good night. It's our whisper.